Our next speaker is Professor Alain Daguet. Alain is a professor of neurology at the Montreal Neurological Institute. He's an expert on neuroimaging in particular. And the title of his presentation is Appetite Systems, Stress, and Modern Environment. You may have to use the mouse.
Okay. So I'm just going to, it's very difficult in a short time to give an overview of the neuroscience of appetite. So I'm going to try to introduce you to what we can do with brain imaging to try to understand obesity and in particular to understand hunger and appetite. So I'll start off with a little quiz. Can anybody name these plants, any of them? All right, so number one, we have marijuana. Number two is cocaine. Number three is tobacco. And number four is grapes or for making wine. So these plants have an evolutionary advantage over other plants because people will grow these in preference to, say, peaches or pears because you can make a lot more money selling these things, even if they're illegal. So these plants are drugs, and they have their evolutionary advantage from the fact that they are addictive to humans, and humans can farm. So, for example, you know, the marijuana plant was probably very rare in the 19th century, and it's taken over an extremely large amount of the planet as a result of being desired by humans. Now, for every single drug of abuse known to us, with the exception of alcohol, the drug was designed to act on a brain. Why is there an addictive drug in the leaves of a plant? Plants don't want their leaves to be eaten normally. And in fact, ironically, the reason those substances are there is to be aversive. They're pesticides. So nicotine, THC, cocaine are pesticides. And they're a particularly great kind of pesticide that instead of killing the animal, they teach it to avoid eating the leaf. So an animal eats a tobacco leaf, gets sick, and learns never to go back and eat that substance. Now, the reason these are also addictive drugs is because of the way they work. They work on learning systems in the brain. And in particular, they release a chemical called dopamine, which is a learning chemical. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter involved in learning about both rewards and punishments. Now, it so happens that humans develop tolerance to the aversive effects. So nicotine, for example, the first time you smoke, you get sick. If you keep smoking, you get tolerance very quickly to those adverse effects, but you still have the possibility to become addicted. Now, here's another plant that uses nicotine as its pesticides. Do you know what plant this is? Yeah. So tomato plants not only use a drug to communicate with animals, they also use food. And plants like tomatoes put sugar or energy in their fruit so that animals will eat them and scatter the seeds. And the plant also communicates with the animal by telling it that the fruit is not tasty when it's green. So the seed is not ready yet to be scattered. The fruit is green and it's bitter. It doesn't contain much sugar. When the animal eats the green fruit, it learns that there's no benefit to eating that, and it learns to avoid it. When it turns red, however, it becomes tasty and full of sugar, and now the animal knows to eat it. So the point is that food, especially carbohydrates, acts on those same learning systems as drugs. So one of the points I'm going to try to make is that there is a tremendous overlap between brain systems involved in responding to drugs and brain systems involved in responding to foods. And if you look at this from sort of an evolutionary standpoint, it's instructive to compare thirst to hunger. Thirst is extremely homeostatic, meaning that you're only thirsty when you lack water. If you have, if you're in water balance, you don't get thirsty, and seeing a glass of water doesn't make you thirsty. If you drink excess water, you just excrete it. So there's no point in drinking when you're not in water deficit. And this may be why water doesn't have the ability to induce craving or thirst. From an evolutionary standpoint, this is thought to be that because water is very easily available, you don't have to hunt it. It's present everywhere on the planet. The same doesn't hold for foods, especially appetitive foods like dessert. So you've just had a meal, you're full, you can't eat another bite, and your dinner partner orders dessert. And seeing that dessert makes you desire it, makes you crave it. Now, how can this possibly make sense? You're not calorie restricted, you're not calorie deficient at that time, quite the opposite. So homeostasis, in the sense of an error signal, in the sense of a signal telling you that you're in calorie deficit, you should eat calories now, does not fully explain hunger. Partly the reason it makes sense to all want to eat this food when it's available is that you can store the calories. Even though you don't need them right now, you can store them for later. And evolutionarily, this is because calories, unlike water, are obtained through effort. And this is especially true of fat calories. So for most animals, including humans, you obtain fat by eating another animal. And that's, of course, very effortful and risky. Carbohydrates, on the other hand, you can get from plants, which are a little easier to catch. So the point is that the sight of food can induce craving even when you're satiated in a non-homeostatic way, and that hunger is a learned behavior. Both of these are features of addiction. Donald Hebb talked about hunger as an addiction over 50 years ago. His model was that the child is born not hungry, but cranky. In other words, the fact of having an empty stomach makes the child agitated, it cries, it's unhappy. And he said that this was something about the stomach being empty. It may have been, he thought it was painful stomach contractions. We now know it's probably more hormones secreted by the gut that signal the brain and create a state of anxiety. The mother responds to this state of anxiety, this agitation and crankiness and crying, by feeding the child, which fills the stomach with calories, which signals to the brain a reward and relieves the anxiety. And through this process, the child learns that high-calorie foods are rewarding. And this is something, obviously, that occurs very quickly in the first few days and weeks of life. And he suggested that this may be why especially high-calorie foods, like milk, remain rewarding for life. Many scientists, including Roy Wise in the 70s, showed that dopamine was involved in the reinforcing effects of food. So that food reward was mediated in part by dopamine. So this is the model of dopamine function and food reward. When a reward is experienced, whether it's a drug or a food, there's release of dopamine in the brain. And the dopamine itself allows the individual to learn about what behavior led to the reward, but it also increases the motivation to obtain the reward. It leads to wanting and craving. With time, conditioned stimuli, that is, neutral cues that are paired with the reward, also acquire the ability to release dopamine. This is like Pavlov's dog, Pavlovian conditioning. So a neutral stimulus that's always paired with the reward eventually acquires incentive properties and itself has the ability to trigger dopamine release and therefore to trigger wanting and craving. So this is why a cigarette smoker who walks into a bar and sees other smokers and smells the tobacco desires a cigarette. It's a conditioned stimulus. And a lot of the studies that all the studies I talk about really use this mechanism. So let's skip ahead. I had more slides. I thought my talk was actually 30 minutes, so I'm going to skip some slides. So we can use functional brain imaging to map out the brain response to food cues. As I was explaining, food cues or drug cues are conditioned incentives. You've learned to associate them with a reward, and they have an effect on your brain, and the result of that effect is to trigger a state of wanting and craving. So with functional magnetic resonance imaging, we can measure the brain response to pictures of food and compare it to some sort of neutral stimulus, in this case, pictures of scenery. And you can see that you can activate brain regions. So if you take a hungry, normal, healthy person and show them food pictures, compare the response to scenery pictures, you get activation in color there in all these brain areas, the orbitofrontal cortex, the amygdala, the insula, visual areas. And I refer to these as an appetitive network. So these regions, plus another one called the striatum, are heavily interconnected. And what these regions of the brain do is they take that cue and transform it into an incentive state and into an action. So if you see food, there are two effects. One is to desire the food, and another one is to plan and act in order to obtain it. Whatever needs to be done to go and obtain that food is now triggered by these brain regions. Now, the amygdala and orbitofrontal cortex are very important. They're involved in many emotional behaviors, including assigning value to stimuli in the environment. So you see things in the environment, you have all these stimuli, and attached to each of these stimuli is a value, which varies tremendously with time. So for example, the value of a food item will depend on how hungry you are. And it's the amygdala and orbitofrontal cortex that assign that value to food items and therefore assign an action and a value to the action. So both the food item and the action, consuming it, are assigned a value, and the behavior that you choose is based on evaluating the actual value of all the options open to you at any given time. So as I said, when we show food pictures, all of these brain regions light up. They become activated by the food pictures, and we know that this is important. For example, the amount of activation that you see in response to these cues predicts behavior. So for example, in smokers, if you show cigarette cues, the brain response to the cues predicts how likely people are to smoke in the near future. It also predicts how likely they are to relapse if they're abstinent smokers. So the other thing about these brain regions is that they all receive dopamine projections. So the dopamine neurons in the brain all send projections to these areas and release dopamine there. So they're not only activated by the cues, we know that they have this dopamine input. So I'm interested in the overlap between drugs of abuse and food. And this is a meta-analysis that we did looking at a whole bunch of fMRI studies, comparing the response to food cues, food pictures, and to smoking cues, for example, pictures of people enjoying a cigarette. And what you can see is that these four appetitive regions that I talked about are activated both by the food cues in healthy people and by the smoking cues in smokers, showing that there is this tremendous overlap between the response to drugs and the response to foods. So why study drug cues? Well, first of all, because they cause relapse. In other words, they are important in society. Smoking, it's thought that one of the main reasons that there's been a decreased incidence in smoking in the Western world is that we've removed smoking cues from the environment through laws. For example, by banning smoking in public, you're less likely to be exposed to other smokers if you're an abstinent smoker. And there is evidence that some of the reduction in smoking is due to the fact that people are no longer smoking in public. You know also that there are cues in the environment related to food. Living in a city, you're constantly bombarded by food cues, and those are a part of the obesogenic environment. Cues not only cause relapse, they also increase consumption. So if you expose someone to food cues and then give them access to food, they will eat more if they've been pre-exposed to cues. And this is in part because cues activate the brain and activate this incentive state. The neural response to cues predicts consumption and relapse, as I explained. Cues are in the environment. And the other important thing is that cues are, as I explained before, conditioned stimuli. So this is what I think happens, or what we think happens in the brain in response to cues. So you see people smoking, that's a cue of smoking behavior. It leads to craving, which is a slow varying function. And craving affects brain activity. So just the amount of craving in itself has an effect on the brain. Now, at the same time, your state of craving interacts with the available cues, in this case, let's say food cues, to modulate the brain response to the cues. In other words, when your craving level is high and you see the cues, their effect on the brain is greater. So on the one hand, the constant exposure to cues increases this baseline craving, and on the other hand, the craving increases the response to the cues. Okay, I'll skip this. Okay, so I'll just skip ahead, and let me just... So in the last few minutes, I just want to show you one study that we've done looking at the effect of gut peptides on the cue response. So the gut is very important in controlling feeding. There are all kinds of hormones secreted by the stomach, the intestine, the fat cells, the liver. And these hormones get into the blood and enter the brain and trigger either hunger or satiety. And one that we've studied in particular is ghrelin, which is secreted by the stomach. So ghrelin is secreted by the stomach, and it is an orexigenic peptide, meaning that it triggers appetite. It increases hunger and increases food intake. So, for example, if you inject ghrelin in humans or animals, they eat more. So it's a hunger signal, and it's secreted by the gut. It's secreted by the stomach just before mealtimes. So if you train an animal to eat at certain times, ghrelin is secreted just before those meals, probably under control of the brain. But ghrelin is also secreted when the stomach is empty. And it triggers the initiation of the meal. Ghrelin acts on the hypothalamus, but interestingly, it also acts on dopamine neurons in the ventral tegmental area, part of the brain where the dopamine neurons are located. So in other words, ghrelin acts on the brain to increase dopamine release. And remember, I explained that dopamine had a role in increasing the incentive value of cues. So the theory that we want to test is that when ghrelin levels are high, the cues are going to have a higher effect on brain activity and therefore on appetite. And so this is indeed what we found. So what we did in this study, we had our subjects in a scanner, showed them the food cues, and we scanned them on two separate days. One day we gave them an injection of saline. Another day we gave them an injection of ghrelin. And as you can see, ghrelin increased the brain response to the cues in the insula, amygdala, and hippocampus. And these are all the regions of the brain that were ghrelin sensitive. And basically all of these regions that I talked about as being the appetitive networks are responsive to ghrelin. Ghrelin, interestingly, also increased memory for the food cues. So when we have the people come back the next day and show them the food pictures and a whole bunch of new pictures, when the pictures that they saw when ghrelin levels were high are more easily remembered. And remember I said that food and drugs act on systems in the brain involved in learning and memory. And so just finally, I want to end with one last concept. So this is a... Well, what do you think this is a graph of? This is year at the bottom. Anyone have an idea?
The inverse of the stock market.
that's possible. So 70s, what happened? What went up starting in the 70s? Well, it could be BMI or obesity if you were to plot those, but it isn't. It's actually consumer spending. And in fact, one theory of why we have an increase in obesity has to do with the economics of food. We're spending more, and one of the things we spend more money on is food. And there is a very important economic aspect to obesity. In the developed world, obesity predominantly affects the poor. Now, this I think you have to be careful of. A lot of people say that, and I've looked at the literature, and it's controversial. But there seems to be a relationship between socioeconomic status and obesity, though it may be less than we think. But unhealthy, energy-dense foods are cheaper than healthy foods. And just like cigarettes, the cost determines consumption. In other words, when the cost of cigarette falls, people smoke more. And when the cost of food falls, people eat more. While we talk a lot about satiety, what's important in eating is the planning stage of the meal. How much you eat is determined by what happens before you start eating. And so food consumed during a meal is determined at the planning stages. Low-income households tend to buy cheap, energy-dense foods and avoid expensive fruits and vegetables, and there's a correlation between the energy content of what you buy and what you eat, not surprisingly. And according to Drunovsky, 40% of the recent increase in weight in America can be attributed to reduced food prices secondary to policy. So one study that we started to do, instead of just showing food pictures, we show food pictures and then we ask people how much they would like to pay for that food, and they get a chance to buy the food after the study. So that's a very good way of determining how much you want that food at this particular instant in time. And so we did our ghrelin study again. We injected ghrelin, and we had people buying food. And what you can see is that under ghrelin, this is the difference in amount of money spent. In blue, it's for food items. In red, it's for trinkets, non-food items like DVDs and baseball hats. What you can see is that under ghrelin, people spend more money on food. In other words, they assign greater value to food. Another way to think about this is if the food cost is the same, when you decide whether or not to buy the food, if ghrelin levels are high, you're more likely to purchase it. And if you purchase it, you're more likely to buy it. So this is just showing that people spend more on high-calorie foods than low-calorie foods, and they spend more under ghrelin than under saline. And this is just to show you that when we correlate these bid amounts, we can actually measure brain response to the actual degree of wanting of the food items. All right, so just to conclude, the link between hunger and drugs, the development of feeding behavior has similarities to drug addiction. It's a learned behavior, and it's not perfectly homeostatic. I mean, drug addiction also is not homeostatic if you think about it. You have this strong desire to smoke or to take cocaine. It's not due to a homeostatic deficiency in nicotine or cocaine, which doesn't make any sense, but your brain interprets it that way. Food and drug cues activate brain areas involved in motivation, reward, and attention, and they predict behavior. Now, pharmacological treatments of obesity aimed at this reward system therefore have a risk of causing side effects, because if you can decrease food intake by reducing the reward response to foods, but you do so at the risk of side effects, and indeed most drugs that act on the brain to reduce food intake also have side effects such as depression. And can lessons from tobacco be applied to obesity? And I ask this because we've had fairly good success in reducing the incidence of smoking. 90% incidence of smoking amongst men who returned from World War I, in part because they were given cigarettes during the war. But now the incidence, actually, now the latest figures are below 10% in California of smokers. And California has been the leader in public policy towards smoking. The effective measures for smoking incidence, for decreasing smoking incidence, have also been applied or suggested for obesity. So increase the cost of food, like taxing high-calorie foods, prohibition, banning certain kinds of high-calorie foods, elimination of cues, for example, banning advertising. Behavioral therapy, which is very effective for drug addiction, is also effective for reducing weight. Replacement therapy, I'm not sure of any really good studies on replacement therapy for food, but one of the things you tell people who are obese is actually not to let themselves get too hungry. So you can tell people to snack, actually, as a way of losing weight. So that's a sort of replacement therapy. And then drugs acting on the reward system, for example, Zyban and Rimonabant, are both smoking cessation drugs, but they also can help in reduce weight. All right, thank you.
Presentation that combined both social and biological factors. We have time for a few questions before the break.
Hi, Julie McLaren with Health Canada in Edmonton. I just wanted to point out, in terms of replacement therapy, I think one sort of interesting theory is that that's a lot of the nutrition work that we do in substituting lower calorie, like, you know, healthier choices for the high satiety, high calorie foods, and also substituting different activities for eating. So if eating is a high reward and compensation mechanism that someone has in their life, providing them with other solutions that will provide the same stimulus, like physical activity, give them that same reward incentive, but and the same brain chemicals, but without the food.
Interesting.
Stimulus.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have one question about the heritability of craving. Are there any sort of case studies on this?
Yes, so Q-reactivity is heritable. Some of the genes that convey that heritability are dopamine receptor genes.
Are you suggesting that Zyban or Rimonabant induce depression?
No. These particular drugs don't. Rimonabant does. It's a cannabinoid antagonist. Zyban is an antidepressant, but it does cause weight loss. In fact, in smoking cessation, one of the advantages of Zyban is that you don't get the weight gain after you quit smoking. Rimonabant was taken off the market because it causes depression.
Just one quick comment in terms of the link between the various levels of measurement. When we talk about Q-reactivity here, it is related to the VA-200 approach, the VAS scale that we're talking about. There has been validation done from the neurocognitive to the VA-200.
All right. Before we break, I'd like to make a brief comment. There has been a long-standing divide between social and biological determinants of health. I think one of the misconceptions about biomarker research is that it really informs only the discovery of biomarkers. And I believe, as Alain showed, many of these research also identify the social systems that are closely intertwined with the sort of biology. So when you do this kind of research, inevitably, if the studies are well designed, we also discover these social systems that can sort of influence and shape human behavior. So it's important to sort of be cognizant of this, that those devices are in some way artificial, and we can actually discover both of those elements. This also dates back to 20th century framing of science as autonomous activity, a view that sort of prevails, especially among scientists. But science essentially really is embedded in a social system, and the boundaries between the natural world and the social world are actually more porous and more sort of related. So thanks again, Alain, for a very interesting presentation, as well as all presenters this morning. We'll break for about 15 minutes, and we'll reconvene at 10 a.m. here. Thank you very much.